Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and welcome to episode 7 of The Prime Effect, our series all about how Amazon is changing the way we shop, work, and live. Today's question: what does Amazon know about you? In a sense, Amazon is a big tech double threat. Not only does it have vast quantities of data about your online buying habits, but the company also reaches into your physical spaces with Alexa-enabled devices, Ring doorbell cameras, and cameras on its ever-growing fleet of delivery vans. So at best, Amazon can be seen as a customer-obsessed corporation that treats customer interests such as privacy as sacrosanct. At worst, Amazon's corporate surveillance capacity makes it an unblinking digital panopticon that never, ever stops watching you, learning about you, and doing exactly what with that information. Take, for example, Amazon's home security device, Ring.
I was at one of these conferences when I saw something about Ring, and this was several years ago. This was right when they were getting started. So I went to go ask about it and what the deal was, and they were walking me through kind of what the point of the program was and how it was helpful from a crime prevention standpoint, and I thought that's pretty cool.
That's Officer Rad Rotello. He's with the Frisco, Texas Police Department, one of the first local law enforcement departments to enter into partnership with Amazon to access the company's Neighbors Public Safety Service, a digital platform that connects Ring camera customers, other community members, and local public services like police and fire departments.
They were talking essentially about the streamline of information to us and our detectives for burglaries and various things. That's what really got my attention. Obviously, we can't put a camera at every corner of every street to see everything, but this was the idea of really getting the public involved in crime prevention as well.
That was 2018. Today, more than 1,800 law enforcement agencies across the nation are on the Neighbors app. Ring describes the platform as a hyper-local safety app that allows customers to communicate with each other and get that information that I talked about earlier. The partnerships have already helped solve criminal cases across the country. Critics, however, call those same partnerships an unprecedented reach into Americans' private lives and property.
There is a lot of misconceptions that I find myself clearing up a lot. That's not something I thought about really beforehand.
And one of those misconceptions, Officer Rotello says, is that Ring cameras feed video directly to law enforcement.
It is illegal for a police department to have access to somebody's private camera feed. Like, that's not something that we are even interested in. That was one of the big discussions when we had the onboarding. We wanted to make sure that what we were signing up for as a police department was in the best interest of our residents and zero violation of any sort of laws or rights that people have. So there's no super secret way for us to go about it. If we want video that a person does not willingly want to share, but we feel like has some sort of value to it as far as solving the crime that we're investigating, then we have to get a subpoena. And at that point, then it's between us and I guess it would be Amazon to say, hey, Frisco PD wants this. Are you willing to share it? No, they're not. Okay. So then we do our paperwork through the court system. And then the court either will say, we agree with the police department, you have to give them this evidence, or no, they don't. Just because now it's on digital doesn't change the fact that there are checks and balances and processes for the police to be able to get any of your information. They can't just take it.
All true. Amazon tells us that despite these partnerships, they do not see law enforcement as their primary customer. The company also launched end-to-end encryption of Ring data this summer, though customers have to opt in for that feature. Moreover, Amazon tells us they don't hand over Ring data without a warrant. Hand that over to law enforcement, that is. However, If there is one defining feature about the digital age, it's this: unprecedented and instantaneous access to vast amount of information. So there's nothing stopping law enforcement agencies from making mass requests to Amazon. Or, here's the wrinkle, making mass requests directly to Ring customers. And sure, customers can say no to law enforcement requests, but Amazon also coaches those same officers on how to get people to say yes, which is why cyber privacy critics see the Amazon law enforcement partnerships as a potentially worrying workaround the Fourth Amendment. Or, as Laura Bridges wrote in The Guardian, quote, Ring is effectively building the largest corporate-owned, civilian-installed surveillance network that the U.S. has ever seen. Well, Ramesh Srinivasan, do you agree with that, or is that a hyperbolic response to the Ring law enforcement partnerships?
It's great to join you, Meghna. I don't think there's any question that what we're talking about when we're speaking about Ring cameras at scale, and there's some evidence that tens of millions of Ring cameras have been sold. It's unclear to know how many are active, but that those cameras at scale, the ability for those cameras to interact with one another through what's called sidewalk bridges, which basically creates a sort of connected surveillance network. And if you connect all of that to, as you just mentioned, that the default is that we are opted in to this data being gathered and potentially provided to law enforcement, not to mention to the company itself, and the fact that all of this data is connected to Amazon Web Services, which dominates the cloud computing market, you can see how what we have signed onto without even knowing is surveillance at a level of scale that we have never seen before. And it's not just corporate surveillance, but it's corporate surveillance connected to, you know, our security groups like the police department and other and the military and Department of Defense, as I'm sure we'll later discuss.
Well, that's Ramesh Srinivasan. He's a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, who explores technology's relationship to economic, political, and cultural life. He's also author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. And I'm really glad to have you back on the show, Professor Srinivasan. Let me now also turn to John Callis. Same question to you, John. Do you see Ring as an example of a huge corporate-owned surveillance network in the United States?
It's good to be here, Meghna. Yes, it is a part of one thing that we're seeing, which is cooperations between corporations and private entities like Ring, like the users of Ring, that are in fact signing up and being part of a vast network that has the ability to provide surveillance to just about everywhere around the country and later around the world.
Okay, so that's John Callis, Director of Technology Projects at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, also a former technologist in the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project, and has experience directly in the tech world as well. He used to work for Apple on security and encryption. So John, it's good to have you as well. So it seems like we wanted to start with Ring as an example here of Amazon and the big concept of digital surveillance in our lives today, because it brings us to this core sort of set of questions. They're like the two binary stars of Amazon that we've found over this series. One is, what is Amazon doing with the power and the information it has now? And two is, what could it do with it in the future? So that's going to kind of be where this show orbits. I'm using a lot of space analogies today, but around those two central questions. But Professor Srinivasan, let me turn back to you here. As you heard me expressly outline there, Amazon says, well, they're not handing over any data, any Ring data to law enforcement without a proper warrant. So the checks and balances, as you heard Officer Rotello talk about, are still in place. So why worry? The legal framework should be there to protect people from, unreasonable searches through Ring.
Right. I mean, it's just stunning to me how, the users of these technologies are so in the dark when it comes to you know, all of these processes, right? There's evidence that, you know, just up till April of 2021, there were 22,000 individual requests by law enforcement that were provided to Amazon around these Ring cameras. We don't know which of these requests are going through and which of them are not. What we do know, and John alluded to this earlier, and I have a lot of love and respect for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is that the specificity and depth and sort of comprehensiveness of that data that's being gathered is occurring on a scale that we have that has never occurred before, right? We're talking a level of scale and a level of intimacy. And we have seen a lot of false positives, problematic criminalization of people occur in cases where that was not actually the case. So my point again is that when I am a consumer and Amazon advertises itself, it proudly boasts of itself as the most consumer-facing company. And I say, hey, I want the convenience of a Ring system. You know, I want the convenience of Echo. What I don't realize is I've signed on to a level of surveillance and potential behavioral control and criminalization of myself and my neighbors that has never existed ever before. And so the value of all of that data is part of why Amazon is the most powerful company, I would say, in the world. And that value of the data helps both its corporate side, but its partnerships with the Department of Defense, with the military-industrial complex, with law enforcement, gives it a whole other level of power as well. We had no idea that we were signing on to surveillance at this scale. And that is exactly what's occurring on every single level when it comes to Amazon.
John, I want to give you 30 seconds here, but how is this different than, say, what Google has with its Nest in-home devices?
Well, the major difference is that these are things that are being marketed to people as home security devices, but there's also the interaction with the Neighbors app, which is one of these apps that lets people talk about their fears with other people, similar to Nextdoor, similar to what the Citizen app does as well. And It is a way that people's concerns and fears can coerce them into handing over things that they might not other in a different situation.
We've got more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about Amazon and surveillance. It's part 7 of our ongoing series about Amazon that we're calling The Prime Effect, where we're taking a look at how Amazon is changing the way we shop, work, and live. And yes, we are talking about all the data that Amazon is collecting about you, not just your online shopping habits, but the data that you're pouring into Amazon servers if you've got an Alexa-enabled device in your home, if you've got a Ring home security doorbell at your front door. And what about what the Amazon trucks are collecting as they drive through your neighborhoods every day? So hop on Twitter or Facebook, we're at On Point Radio, and let us know what your concerns are about Amazon's ability to collect both physical and digital data about you, what advantages you see to this, what is the good that could come out of this? And I'm curious to know what folks think about how we balance the concerns about negative uses of this mass corporate surveillance, how we balance that against what could come out of it from a positive aspect. Is there a regulatory path you see ahead of us? Again, we're at On Point Radio on Twitter and Facebook. I'm joined today by Ramesh Srinivasan from UCLA and John Callis from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And gentlemen, we've already been receiving a lot of feedback from listeners about surveillance in Amazon. So just listen to On Point listener Peter, who called us from Pasadena, California. And he says he's worried about how these Amazon devices are they're increasing society's willingness to sacrifice privacy.
These things like the Ring and these front door cameras are perpetuating something that is actually a felony in California. You cannot record anyone unless you have their permission before you do it. And it's becoming normalized that those kinds of cameras and also, you know, cell phones, you can just record anybody and your brother. I wish it would stop.
That's Peter from Pasadena, California. John Callis, help us understand this here, because I imagine we're entering quite a legal gray area. Is it a felon? Are these Ring cameras actually committing a felony if they're on the doors of California homeowners?
It's not a felony to have a security camera on your property that's looking at what you are doing. But I believe that the listener is talking about an effect that is a sort of creeping into from normal things. Like when we started off with cameras being a thing about 200 years ago, we as society made a bunch of decisions. And one of those decisions was that you could take a picture of, say, you know, a street or a park, and that you didn't have to get the permission of every single person who was in the frame. Manners is a different thing than legal requirement, but you can take a picture of where you are. And it is said that when someone walks down the street, because we all have often more than one camera on us, that you could take a picture of something, and it's like every city block that you walk, between 10 to 15 times, you'll be in some camera. We've seen this in a bunch of news things, in a bunch of significant events that happen. I mean, for example, number of years ago when there was the Boston Marathon bomber, combination of security video, things that people had been taking just as they were doing, allowed within a couple of days analysis of what went on. Sometime later, there was an airplane crash at San Francisco Airport, and it turned out that somebody simply happened to be recording video at the time that the plane was descending. So there was live cell phone video from across the bay, but it was nonetheless video that just happened to be there. And as these things go on, and as you start seeing that anybody can take a picture, then you have things like cameras that are on fixed locations, like utility poles, like people's houses, that those have a certain limited purpose, but they get turned into something by having artificial intelligence looking at them all the time. It used to be that tapes would be on sort of a loop, and that every day or two or three or even month, the tapes would be rewritten. Now you have real-time analysis of these things that is robot surveillance of many cameras across the world. And as more of this goes on and more analysis and on top of the analysis, then connection into police departments through apps that request that somebody send something, it turns from something that is normal into something that is genuinely creepy and into a legal gray zone.
Right. Okay. So there's a lot to dig into there. I do have to note that you know we're a show that's based out of Boston, and when you mentioned the Boston Marathon bombing, one wonders how the investigation might have been different today than it was when the bombing happened. Because yes, there were lots of cameras on the streets of the marathon that were able to identify the figures of the bombers themselves when they placed those terrible backpacks on Boylston Street in Boston, but it didn't help them find them. That technology at that time did not help them find these guys. And ultimately, you know, one of them died in a shootout and the other was found virtually by accident after, you know, a massive 24-hour lockdown of the greater Boston area and, you know, the huge amounts of law enforcement crawling all over. They still couldn't find him. So one wonders how it would have been different today. And so with that thought, Ramesh Srinivasan, let me turn back to you here, because I think what the important thing that John is getting at is how things become slowly normalized. So I'd like to push that a little bit further with respect to Amazon here and talk about how this is speculation at this point, but what might the future look like, right, with Amazon's ability to collect all this digital information and then also the kinds of physical information that we're talking about? Let's just take the cameras example that John was mentioning. You know, is it out of the realm of possibility to imagine a future in which Amazon, through the combination of video surveillance and AI and facial recognition, could track me, say, if I've got a Ring doorbell on my front door, there's Amazon trucks going all around my neighborhood. I've got the app on my phone, so it kind of knows where I am and what I'm buying, that it could track me throughout my whole day. Amazon could track me throughout my whole day. And then this could ostensibly be a revenue source for the company if they wanted to sell a service that said, like, track Megna. Is that possible?
Oh, without question, it's possible. Amazon is operating with lush revenue streams in so many different pathways, right? Not just its contracts with security, obviously its e-commerce platforms, its Amazon Web Services platform, which dominates every other competitor, a couple times, twice as powerful as its competitors. And we all remember, or some of us may remember, when we used Amazon just to buy books. And, in a sense, I sort of think of the Looney Tunes Acme company that just dominates everything. Everything is done through Acme. This is where Amazon is attempting to head. It is able to sort of manipulate that false distinction between privacy and security that we have, where we think where it sort of proffers convenience and consumer-facing sort of devices and services. But in reality, what it is attempting to do is to be inside our homes, potentially analyzing our bodies biometrically, all around our neighborhoods, literally combing the streets, as I mentioned earlier, everywhere. I'm looking out my window right now. I see an Amazon truck, sure enough. I wonder if it's looking at me, right? And all the e-commerce data as well. So all of this can be aggregated. We also know that Amazon is using census data as well, external data sets, right? So it's the attempts here by Amazon are to basically be the mediating aspect of every aspect of our lives, every component of our lives. Our lives are the raw materials upon which Amazon as a corporation operates. So that is why we see Amazon extending itself in all of these different realms. And I just want to make the point that Amazon operates on the internet and its delivery vehicles use our roads. Both of those are things that we, the American taxpayers, paid for, yet we have such little understanding, let alone power, over Amazon's corporate activities.
Okay, so let me just jump in here, Ramesh.
Yeah.
You just said that Amazon is attempting to be the mediating factor across almost every imaginable aspect of our lives. I mean, you're casting Amazon as this omnipotent corporate force over humanity. That seems, I mean, look, I am all for being very critical of where big tech is going, but that seems a little extreme.
Well, I mean, there are competitors to Amazon. There are people like ourselves who are coming out and raising some critical viewpoints. But I think that we need to understand, let's look at where Amazon has gone over the past decade, even the past 20 years. And it's astonishing how it's entered all of these different realms, a company that doesn't pay any taxes, whose founder and CEO is the wealthiest person in the history of the world or close to it, right? Look at its attempts to basically take over every single market it can, right? And also take over our personal lives and our relationships with security, as well as our, you know, taxpayer money, which over 50% go to the Department of Defense. So, you know, I think this is more aspirational by Amazon than the current reality, but I think it's extremely, and my goal is to not be, you know, sort of a doomsayer, but to arm the public with the tools where we at the minimum have a right to understand what Amazon is doing with all of this data that it's collecting about our lives. And John made a very important point about the facial recognition technologies, right? We can see how, you know, facial recognition technologies might be compared with databases or data sets for mugshots of criminals, or, for example, the Department of Homeland Security, which has a massive contract with Amazon, was using its facial recognition technology with ICE raids, Immigration and Customs Enforcement raids, right near where I live here in Los Angeles, and misidentifying people who are actually documented as undocumented. But it's too late. These people are already criminalized as a result of these mistakes being built by this technology, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are other issues at play there. But my point is, we have given this private corporation so much power, and I don't want us to blame ourselves. I want us to be armed with the tools so that we can check and balance the situation.
Okay, so we're getting some comments about just exactly this point. Damian Williams sent us this message saying, John and Ramesh's comments start to get at the connection between AWS's computer vision work, the Amazon recognition system, which is that facial recognition system, and the proliferation of facial recognition and carceral surveillance systems throughout the United States and the West. And, you know, you can imagine how these technologies could be used in a more overtly authoritarian nations, right? Like, why wouldn't a government go to Amazon and say, well, we want you to hand over everything that the Alexa-enabled devices are hearing because it will allow us to keep, you know, citizens safer. I mean, so John Callis, though, let me just get your take on a fundamental question here. Do you think that because of this both physical presence or penetration into people's lives plus the digital collection of data, does that make Amazon distinctly different from the surveillance capitalism practices of, you know, Google and Facebook, or is it kind of all one of a piece?
It's different, but it's similar. That the big tech companies are all into different sorts of things. I mean, Amazon is primarily two different things. It is a retailer and it is a cloud computing system. And that cloud computing portion of it, AWS, competes with Microsoft's Azure or Google's cloud systems. And the retail part competes, of course, with other big retailers like Walmart, supermarket chains, and so on and so forth. The connection between those and where the data flows back and forth and what the barriers that are between it are what matters. Because there are plenty of things that we want Amazon as a retailer to know. It's very useful for them to know all the records that I have bought to help me get more of them and to do things like, as time goes on, CDs that I bought physically I can then stream. It's useful to be able to have a record of what I've been doing in the Whole Foods grocery stores because that helps me understand what I am doing with my purchases. But where are they going? Because that's data that's useful to me, and who else is doing it? And the surveillance capitalism portion is, in fact, that information is useful as a currency, and there are many things that we do where we're paying for the service by giving them our information. Free Facebook is paid for by your information. And understanding that is something that we ought to be able to be doing better, to comprehend that our information has value, and even that value increases the more there is of it.
Well, so Ramesh, let me turn back to you. And John, I want to hear you on this as well. We just got a couple minutes before the next break. But I wonder, of the legal safeguards that are in place, let's just stick with the Ring example for a moment. I mentioned the Fourth Amendment before, right? I mean, there is a constitutional amendment that guarantees the right to freedom from unreasonable search of not just your home, but your person as well. So we have that to rely on. Then what about also, Amazon would argue that it's not in its business incentive to do things that are counter to the interests of its customers, you know, the customer obsession this company has. So sacrificing customer privacy in the partnership, the very partnerships that we've talked about with law enforcement, the government as well, perhaps isn't something that Amazon wants to pursue all that vigorously because it undermines its, you know, fundamental strength as a corporation. Would you rely on those things to sort of be guardrails against the abuse of the data that it's collecting?
I think, Meghna, that all of this are potential. I mean, what all of these issues and challenges represent are different pathways that Amazon can take. It can pivot off of a particular, you know, model of power simply based on issues or challenges or embarrassing issues that may occur. But let's remember, one of the biggest customers for Amazon is Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, and other sorts of state surveillance departments. So I think it's very, very important for us to understand the potential that can occur here and what has been signed onto as a result, and recognize that many of us simply think that when we use Amazon, we're simply just buying and selling products. We don't realize that it's all tied to this massive surveillance apparatus where a private corporation has these sorts of partnerships with the state and states around the world, authoritarian states, as you mentioned.
Well, Ramesh Srinivasan and John Callis, stand by. There's so much more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's episode 7 of our ongoing series about Amazon. We're calling it The Prime Effect, where we're taking a look at all the ways in which Amazon is changing the way we shop, work, and live. And today we are focusing on the question of surveillance. What does Amazon do with the vast amounts of information we are giving it every day, not just regarding what we buy on Amazon.com, but maybe what we say in our homes if you've got an Alexa-enabled device, or what Amazon can see if you've got a Ring home security system there by your front door, or what those delivery vans, those now seemingly ubiquitous delivery vans, are seeing every day when they drive through the streets of your neighborhood. What does it do with all that information? What does it mean about the future of digital surveillance, of corporate digital surveillance, in this country and around the world? I'm joined today by Ramesh Srinivasan, who's a professor in UCLA's Information Studies Department. John Callis is also with us from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And, you know, we've talked a lot about Ring devices, for example, and the impact on citizens and consumers that Amazon's ability to peer into our lives might have. But I want to switch gears for a second and talk about worker surveillance here, and physical surveillance of workers, because we talked to Anthony, a delivery driver who worked for an Amazon delivery service provider for about a year and a half. And he asked that we not use his last name due to his concerns, his fears of retaliation, and that other delivery contractors may not hire him in the future if they found out that he spoke with us. But Anthony did tell us that typically, when he was working for that Amazon delivery service provider, that a busy 8-hour, you know, shift would include 120 stops on his route in the Arlington Heights, Illinois area. And during peak season, though, it was more like 200 stops a day.
They are monitoring us constantly through a work phone that they give us every day to run our route. So they know exactly where we are, and they have a computer algorithm tracking, you know, how many stops per hour we're doing. So we're constantly on the clock, constantly being rushed. If you fall behind even a little bit, there's a dispatcher that will text you or call you and, you know, say, hey, you're behind. You need to pick it up.
Now, specifically, and to be clear, Anthony as a driver and the dispatcher as well are not direct employees of Amazon, because Amazon, for many of its deliveries, hires third-party delivery service providers, or DSPs, as they're known, like the one Anthony worked for. However, Anthony says those same DSPs are still required to track drivers on their routes.
So say, for example, I'm on like a four-lane, real busy road, like Arlington Heights Road, and the stops kind of jump back and forth across the street. You know, I don't know what they expect me to do, you know, run across four lanes of traffic like I'm playing real life Frogger or something, or, you know, I wouldn't do that because that's not safe. So I would skip those stops and come back to them later. And then they would call me up and they'd be like, hey, why'd you skip those stops?
Well, in February of this year, Anthony says that Amazon asked that he sign a consent form for cameras to be installed in delivery vans. He resisted signing that form until he was told he wouldn't be given any more routes unless he signed.
Well, based on, you know, everything they were doing before that, micromanaging us with the GPS app, my thought was that they're just going to use us to micromanage us even further.
Now, we asked Amazon about the purpose of putting cameras inside their delivery vans, and an Amazon spokesperson said in a statement, quote, the primary purpose of the Netradyne camera system is to help keep drivers and the communities where we deliver safe, end quote. Amazon also said that in the pilot program for what it calls, quote, camera-based safety technology, that accidents decreased 48%. Stop sign violations decreased by 20%. Driving without a seatbelt went down 60%. And distracted driving decreased 45%, things that they attribute to the camera-based safety technology. But to Anthony, he sees the cameras as more a cynical act than safety measure.
It's not just a camera. It's like an AI-powered thing. So, like, it's looking at you. It can tell like where your eyes are looking. It can tell if you stop completely at a stop sign for like a full 3 seconds, or if you only do 1 or 2 seconds. Like, it's just extremely invasive.
And that's Anthony from Arlington Heights, Illinois. He worked for an Amazon delivery service provider in 2019 to 2021, about a year and a half there. So, John Callis, let me just put this question to you. I'm still thinking about those very powerful reductions in unsafe driving behavior that came after Amazon put some cameras in their delivery vans. I mean, why shouldn't a company try to use whatever technologies that are available to make both their employees and then the neighborhoods that those employees are working in safer?
Well, there's a lack of context in here. And there is also a spectrum of what they are looking at that goes from things that are easily measurable, like how long you stopped at a stop sign, to distracted driving. I mean, what is distracted driving? How is their machine learning system measuring it? And I have a certain skepticism on the latter, that there is not a good definition of what this means. We humans know it, but we haven't been able to put it into an algorithm. And I would say that portion of it is pseudoscience. So this is going from something that is reasonable into purely speculative.
Okay. So isn't that the transition that we all have to manage as a society too, right? So Ramesh, I just want to turn that same question to you. What are your concerns, which I presume you have them, about the cameras that Amazon has in its DSP vans and its own vans as well?
I think it's worth noting, Meghna, that these cameras, as you mentioned, are not only inside these vans, in a way that can only quite realistically promote anxiety amongst drivers who are themselves are not unionized employees at this company, but also that their cameras are, there are also external facing cameras that are, as we talked about earlier, combing data about neighborhoods, you know, perhaps the logistics of where these Amazon delivery vehicles are traveling is not simply based on the efficiency of providing us with the goods that we order, but also in gathering sophisticated data about various neighborhoods. So, you know, these cameras are recording pedestrians, homes, other vehicles, license plates. And I think more generally, when we want to talk about Amazon's relationship with human beings, specifically its laborers, we can understand quite clearly that Amazon's primary and pretty much seemingly sole objective is to extract as much as possible from these laborers. You know, we see evidence of wristbands, for example, with Amazon Fulfillment Center workers and plenty of cameras in these fulfillment centers, which are basically like factory production, that are measuring people's productivity and even making, you know, not letting people take bathroom breaks at certain times. So if we are all, you know, if we, being people who work for Amazon, are cogs in their machine of just, you know, creating greater and greater power, whether through the speculated value of data or in actual profits, we can understand how Amazon treats its workers accordingly. And there's some evidence also to consider that all of this data is being used to fuel the construction of robotic and automated systems that at some point will eventually replace these human beings and these workers themselves. So that poses great economic threats to a digital economy that, quite honestly, is not really supporting the working and middle classes, in my opinion.
You know, the surveillance of workers in the fulfillment center is such a vast topic in and of itself. It could devote several hours just to that. So I'm actually grateful that you brought that up, Professor Srinivasan.
Thanks.
Look, I want to provide some context, some broader context here, which I know both of you are familiar with, but it'll help our listeners sort of as we move towards the final portion of this show, which I want to talk about sort of next steps for us more broadly as a society regarding this kind of surveillance that a company like Amazon is able to do on all of us. So here's just a couple of facts. Again, I know that both of you already are familiar with this, but we're starting to see, for example, information collected by Alexa-enabled devices show up in criminal investigations or as evidence in court, right? I mean, there was this a New Hampshire judge, Ramesh, which you pointed us to, who ordered Amazon to submit Echo recordings in a double murder
That's
investigation.
Right.
Other analysts have called the Alexa-enabled devices effectively like in-home wiretapping that people are willingly putting in their homes. Interestingly, if we look abroad, I believe that at one time, the European Union ordered the halting of the transcription of voice recordings that Amazon was taking through Alexa-enabled devices as well. And then there's also another issue about how the facial recognition that we talked about earlier, that Amazon in the past has sold facial recognition technology to law enforcement. So just a couple of little examples there on how Amazon has used or the effect, the impact of Amazon's technologies on our lives. Now, I should say that Amazon told us in a statement regarding Ring specifically that privacy, security, and user control are foundational to everything we do. And then they went on to say more broadly that this includes designing our products with features that keep those principles front and center. It also means striving to innovate and invent new and better ways to uphold customer privacy and security and give users control over their devices and personal information. End quote. That is a statement, an official statement from Amazon. So what I'd like to do in the last 5 minutes that we have here is talk about what should we as a society do? Because I don't see any right now, any extant regulation that begins to adequately grapple with the potential for the use of all this corporate surveillance. So, John, where would you begin? What's a first step that you would take down a regulatory path? And is that even indeed the right framework to look at here? Is regulation what's needed, or is there something else entirely?
I think regulation is needed and regulation is useful, and as well as other mechanisms, such as just merely having principles in place that companies will adhere to. In terms of what's happening now, there is, as you mentioned, there is a move towards robotic and automated systems. The FAA is, even as we speak, going through having regulations be put in place for drones that are going beyond line of sight. Many of these drones have a lot of useful purposes because they do inspections of pipelines, power lines, etc., that right now are being done by persons by helicopters. But it's also things like Amazon has been saying, delivery by drones, and we'd like to have limits on how long the data is kept, that after a successful flight has completed, that any video they might have picked up will be deleted. And this is something that can be handed directly to the delivery vans, etc., that when there has been no problem, delete the data. To have it so that data that a device like an Alexa has ages out, that it isn't kept, it isn't monetized permanently and becomes an ever-increasing database, but it is something that is used for its purpose, and then it is removed.
Okay, so that seems to be a very concrete and actionable thing to do, to design regulations around. But Ramesh, I also understand that, I mean, Amazon is so big, it's so vast, and it's so present in various sectors, right? Web services, yes. Home products, et cetera, that even if we were able to enact what John is very wisely calling for, just simple laws around delete data when it's no longer useful, would Amazon be able to do that? Doesn't even know where all the data associated with Ramesh Srinivasan might be across its vast digital properties?
Right. In fact, Meghna, we've seen some examples of how, you know, users that have deactivated their accounts, the data has remained with Amazon, or even in certain cases where Amazon has made some, you know, sort of statements saying, hey, we'll destroy your data. It's been discovered later that they still have that data. So there's a certain kind of like technical messiness to this whole process. But I think what John is speaking about is important, which is the retention of data, retaining data, right? Like, how long should this data be available? And who exactly has this data at Amazon? And what exactly are the benchmarks by which they provide that data to third parties? So that's the retention aspect. There's also the aggregation of data I alluded to earlier, right? Amazon not only has my intimate transaction history in terms of things I'm buying and selling, but anytime I use Instagram or Netflix or even many government services, Amazon Web Services then has that data. Is that appropriate? I think not, because those should be disaggregated human activities. What I do when I'm on Instagram having fun should be different than what I buy on Amazon. And I, the human being, the user of technology, should have power over managing my own identity across these different platforms. But that's not what's occurring here on any level at all.
Can you disaggregate, though, when Amazon is one company?
Absolutely, they can. Absolutely, they can. Okay. The problem, though, is when Amazon makes statements saying, hey, we are committed to user privacy and security, it's just a very bland, generic statement. What are they materially doing to actually elevate the human being, the customer, the user, who they claim that they most deeply care about? And I see very little in terms of any details on this.
Well, Ramesh Srinivasan is a professor at UCLA's Department of Information Studies who explores technology's relationship to economic, political, and cultural life, and director of the UC Digital Cultures Lab, author of Beyond the Valley as well. Professor Srinivasan, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so very much for joining us.
This was great. Thank you, Meghna.
And John Callis, Director of Technology Projects at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who also previously worked for Apple on security, user experience, and encryption. John, it was terrific to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much as well. It was a pleasure to be here.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.